Make sure I have a good microphone. Okay. Well, we ended last time. The one thing I didn't manage to do before I went to San Francisco was go through the entire interview from last time. And where we ended last time was we got all through the WTA period, and through the separation from Kermit and meeting Saul, and we talked briefly about the training program.
The machine shop.
Mm-hmm. Very briefly. So what I'd like to start with is a little bit more detail about the training program and when the decision to move to Detroit occurred, and then get into getting the first job in Detroit and becoming involved in the union there.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe if you can first discuss. Now, the training program was still under the WTA, wasn't
yes,
it?
Yes, it was. Uh-huh. That was part of training people for the factory. And I gave up the supervisory job, you remember, at the hospital, in order to, and at that time they thought that I was kind of crazy because I didn't know how soon WPA would be ending, but I was very sure that it was ending. And that was part of the WPA project. And you were trained on lathes and grinders and milling machines and how to rebuild your calipers and all the rest of these things that would be necessary, general work, so that when you went into a factory, you had the acquaintance with a machine, and you would know how to operate it, and you would be fairly proficient. You wouldn't, you know, you would be specialized. And of course, most of them went into mass production anyway, where all you did was just pull a lever for a punch press or something.
Now, how did they recruit people into the training project? Do you
know? It was announced on all projects that if they wanted to transfer from the ditch digging or from whatever, it was on the bulletin boards of the WPA projects, wherever we were. And at the beginning, there weren't too many women. And when I went into it, I think there were mainly men, as I recall. There were some. And
did they stick with it through the whole program?
The women that were in there with me? Yes, they all did. After all, they were getting paid, you see.
Oh, you were getting paid during the training?
Of course. You were getting through the training course. WPA was paying you for taking this course. It wasn't the same rate of pay as you would get in the supervisory capacity that I needed because I had the two children. But I was preparing to go into the factories as soon as possible to be one of the first women. And again, I don't remember the year that I left for Detroit when I completed it shortly after.
How long was the training in Detroit?
I think it was only an 8-week course.
And
that
was
could
a daily,
be
a daily
Oh, yes. Mm-hmm. 5 days a week.
Mm-hmm. And were you, at that point, you were supporting the children yourself, or was Kermit sending some
money? No. I was supporting the kids. I was very, very supporting the kids then.
And the intention was just immediately after the training program to move to Detroit?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, I couldn't get into any factory, and I was pretty sure that I wouldn't be able to get in any factory in Flint because everybody knew me. And so I went down, Saul came back, and I can't tell you the year, I'd have to look it up. Saul came back from, he was injured, you know, and he came back, and we moved to Detroit, and I first hired in at Bud Wheel. And Bud Weir was just taking women in at that time in the shell department, the munitions department. And they were just taking women in, and I'll never forget, Shana, when we went into that plant. Now, remember, I was a TB patient, you know, this is bad health and everything, but they took you if you were breathing, you know, if you were healthy and you were breathing, and everybody they took into the plant. And when we walked in there, we women, much smaller and everything else, the men said, well, if these damn women want to come in here and get the same money that we do, we're going to move over on the easy jobs and give them the hard jobs. And so help me God, that's exactly what happened. And I got put on a shell testing job that was a backbreaker, absolute backbreaker. And if I'd had any sense, I probably would have, you know, concerned about my health, I would have walked out of there. But I felt I had to get in and know what it was like to be inside of a plant this time. I hadn't been in one before working. And so I stuck with it. And let's see, what millimeter shell would that be? It would be a shell that would be about 16 or 18 inches long. And you had to stoop down like this from a conveyor belt that was on the floor. A very bad arrangement. Stoop down and get these things and put them up on a fluid tester. It was a cream white fluid. And I put this shell up there to test them for leaks and let's see, what else? And then they had to test the threads at mm-hmm. one end and whatever the specific instructions were. We had to do all of this and then load them over like this. And it was constantly bending over. And because it was so heavy and awkward, you could only do one at a time, as I recall.
How many women went into the tank?
At Bud Wheel, how many went in there? I think the first group of us that went in must have been about 20 or 25. And this was the first day we walked into this one particular department of Bud Wheel in Detroit. And it was about 20 or 25. And we were completely new, you know, to this kind of war production and so on. And on the break that we had, I always wanted to go around and inspect every operation in that plant. Even the forging, the big electrical forges and the bullet machines that were so automated that they did many operations in with one machine. And I asked people about their jobs on my breaks and on my lunch hour and so on. But the job was a killer. And if I think, when I came home at night, I actually could just make it to the bed and I'd stiffen right out. It was was far too much for me, far too much.
Now, by this time, you and Saul were together, and he was
yes.
in Detroit with you.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
General, what was it, do you recall anything about the other women who went in there with you? What were there? Were these women who had been in the home and now with
yes.
war production?
Yes,
all
of them.
All of them.
And I didn't get acquainted. I was over there less than 3 months because my record in Flint caught up with me, and I was fired. And I was told why I was fired.
Well, let me ask, when you were... hired first at Bud Wheel,
mm-hmm.
there was no problem. Anyone who arrived was accepted. There was
yes.
no security clearance.
Not at that time. It came through later. I don't know whether they put it through on everybody and then the information came back later or how the procedure was. But at any rate, probably the FBI got information when I moved to Detroit and they immediately contacted Briggs Management and I was released.
Bud
Management, I'm sorry. Right.
Was the UAW in at Bud Wheel yet?
Yes, that was Local 306. And ordinarily, they manufactured, you know, the wheels, the rims, and for trucks and all sizes of cars, that kind of operation. And when it went over to the war production, it became one of the biggest shell producers in the nation. And it was packed, and it was a horrible place to work when there were doors that they had to have trucks going through all of the time. And in the coldest weather, yes, we went down there in the wintertime. I can't tell you the date, but I know it was in the wintertime. The cold blast would just blow in over the whole department. So then they had heaters mounted up like that, and you would come in a hot blast of air if you couldn't stand right in it. And then you go from hot to cold, and a lot of the workers were ill, very ill. They screw these plants together without any thought, you know, so rapidly. When America mobilized, mm-hmm. believe me, it was a dynamic Detroit, and Detroit just transferred over into war production so rapidly that the consideration of the worker naturally wasn't even thought about.
Did the union take up the working conditions at all?
Now, the union was changing also. They had probably the same officers. They attempted to, but while their most militant and youngest members were leaving, being drafted and being sent over or already over, you got all of this influx of brand new raw workers who'd never been in a union, didn't know, as we used to say, shit from Chinola. And it was a matter of going around and trying to educate them. Some of them were very hostile at first, these women, you know, when they came into the factory. No, you're not telling me what to do. You told my husband what to do, and so on. And it was a big educational job. It didn't take long in the city of Detroit, and especially with some of the Polish and Hungarian people who knew what a drastic change the union had made in their economic conditions in the home. But we had a lot of professional women who left their jobs of teaching, of nursing, of dental assistants, and things like this for the big money of the auto factory.
Mm-hmm.
They were paying, you know, two and three times the wages then that they could make in their other professions, and these were the ones that were very difficult to get at.
They were more difficult than the women who just came out of the home?
Yes, yes. Uh-huh. Even the women who came out of the home, their husbands very often, especially the foreign-born families,
mm-hmm.
their husbands considered that wasn't any woman's business, anything to do with unionism, so they didn't know about unionism. They just knew generally it was a good thing because it increased the paycheck coming into the home, and the husband was in favor. The husband might have gone to union meetings, or he might not have, but it was a good thing generally.
Yes.
But they didn't want to be involved. They had, at that time, the care of their home, the care of their children, sometimes of their older parents, and working, laundry, everything else,
mm-hmm.
shopping. And they didn't want to get too involved. All right, you got to check off system here and do things. Fine, but don't bother me.
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't quite so easy in the beginning, as to talk about union policy, because everything was in such a state of flux.
Now, did you become... Oh, before I ask about that, it sounds like the women who came out of the home were predominantly working-class women rather than middle-class women.
Oh, yes, predominantly. Of course, you're right.
But the middle-class women were the ones who were already working out of the home in various middle-class
yes.
professional
right.
fields.
Right.
Now, when you went to Budweil during that 3 months, were you involved in the local...
Local 306?
Mm-hmm.
Yes, I went to some of the meetings. No, wait a minute. No, I didn't.
But did you mention before something about a 90-day trial?
That's right. I didn't go. Where we discussed things was we had within the Socialist Workers' Party at that time a faction, a Budweil faction. I went to meetings discussing, to listen to them discuss the needs of the local and their program and their activities. Those were the only meetings that I attended. Uh-huh.
How large was Budweil in terms of the total
number of employees? No, I would have to. It's a pretty big plant, but it's nothing like Briggs or Chrysler or Ford complex.
More like several hundred? No.
It would probably be more like Budweil, about 8,000, something like that.
And how many would be at the
SWC factory? We didn't have too many. We had probably 5 or 6 at the time. 5 or 6. Because they were... I was asked to go into Budweil. But they decided they needed help in their program inside of the local union. And they had a very competent man who was... came out of, what part of Toledo he came out of, I think. Bert Cochran. He became an editor. And he became, he's well known, he's an author mm-hmm. today, right? He was in Budweil at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And they wanted to build up a group around him. He had a lot of ideas
mm-hmm.
that he wanted to propose the International Union from the local.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was asked to go in there to begin with. And when I was fired...
Were you the only woman in the faction?
Yeah. At that time.
Mm-hmm.
And I believe that I don't think they had any women after that, any of the faces. And when I was fired, I was consulting with the faction members again, and they, and I was always talking to people. They felt perhaps that I had something, because I was always getting acquainted, and I was always, finding out about this and that and the other thing. And I said, now that I'm fired, where do you think I should go to work? And he said, oh, God, I don't know. Nobody can handle you. That's practically what they told me, You go your own merry way, You don't, it was one of those things where they wanted kind of complete control, the men in the movement. And we throw up our hands on you. So I said, well, the hell with it. I'll go over to Briggs, because I knew Emil Macy's local from the Flint days, Emil then had been drafted into the Army. He was still the president of the local. And I didn't go to see him because I wanted to keep absolutely incognito. This time, I used the name of Dollinger.
When you hired him?
Before, it was Johnson, Denora Johnson, yes.
Now, what happened was that there was a 90-day trial period.
Mm-hmm.
After that trial period, did they fire him
then? I think it was, it was either right after or just before, and I don't know which.
And what did they tell you exactly?
Well, it said esoterically, but what they let me know was that they knew all about me, with that look in their eye. And that the discussion was ended, there was your pink slip and you turn in your two checks, and that was it. So naturally, I knew that if they ever got a record in Flint, nobody, we knew what the blacklist was, you know, before, so nobody would want to hire me. So I went over to Briggs to hire him. And this I'll never forget because it came up in a later grievance. I went to the hiring manager. He was a very nice man. And he liked my diction. And he knew that I was very well educated. And I gave him all my qualifications, my training school. I mentioned that I didn't mention anything about being in the factory. You had to fill out a form. Had you ever worked in the factory before? No. Well, I hadn't under the name of Dollinger. And a number of other questions, you know, and I answered them so that I could get into the factory. And after I got it all filled out and I handed it in, he said, look, you're far too nice a girl to go in with those ordinary factory women in there. You're not just a factory girl. You should have a better job. How about your coming up here in the personnel office and interviewing workers? And I said, no, I don't think I'd be interested in that at all. And after all, I find this work exciting. I have been trained, and I'm proud of my training. And, you don't want to do anything like that. I'm sure your family would prefer to have you up here in the front office, and I would be glad to give you a job. No, won't you please assign me to one of the jobs? Well, I tell you what, we have, you could at least just go on inspection and not go on production. You knew how hard those jobs were in there. And I said, that would be fine. That would be just fine. So he said, but I don't have any openings right now on inspection, so I'll have to assign you to the Brunner Highway plant on production. But I'm going to keep you in mind, my dear. And as soon as there is an opening in Department 15, because you know how to read blueprints, you know how to use the calipers and the mics and so on, I'll have you transferred over there. I said, you're such a wonderful man. And he said, I'm going to keep you in mind because I'm very impressed with your, you know, I was supposed to be a lady, not a woman, a lady. So I went over to Brunner Highway, and it was difficult. Again, there was a drill press going through that hard fiber wood, you know.
What were they using?
Of all airplanes, this was all airplane production. Small parts for the airplanes. They were making the B-21 and the big bomber planes. And this was just constantly pulling down the lever, pressing to get it through, and, you know, and then taking out another one. And such a dull, boring thing, and you couldn't talk to anybody over there. You know, and you break it to try to get acquainted. And I was going screwy on that job. This was practically all women. Practically all women. And so I kept on his case. I decided that he would forget about me. So many thousands of workers going into those plants then. You were less than a digit, you know. So I made another approach to him. I went up to see him. I'll keep you in mind. I said, I know it's very difficult with the number of people that you deal with every day and so on. But he did, actually, about a couple of weeks after, have me transferred over to the main plant on Max Avenue in Department 15, the famous inspection department. Now, this department was practically all women. They had the number of men increased as the returning injured vets came back. They were given this special place because much of it was sitting on stools, on, you know, and inspecting before benches under the heavy fluorescent lights. And so this department was all behind cribs. Do you know what cribs are? This is heavy, heavy metal fencing that any other part of the plant can't, and members of any other department can't come into. It was Army, Navy, and Air Force cribs. And it was
separately?
Government inspection, sure.
But the Army, Navy,
yes.
Air Force had
well,
separate?
Yes, they had separate, but they were just with a fence between them. It was all Department 15, Army, Navy, and Air Force cribs. And so when I landed there, they had an old man who had been a steward. What was his name? Powell. Mr. Powell. He had to come in from another department because he wasn't an inspector, blueprint inspector, or anything. He had to come in. And he was going to take care of all these little girls. You know, he would do the bargaining for them and so on. And there wasn't any organization. Very few of the women belonged to the union at the time. And me, I had to keep buttoned up. And I mean, I didn't even want to get too well acquainted with anybody.
Because of the trial period still, is that it?
Well, because I didn't want them to catch up with me again before I got seniority.
Oh.
So, because they had a right just to dismiss you like that without seniority. And afterward, it became a union matter then. You see, after the 90-day trial period, then the union had a right to take up your grievance. Prior to that, that was the prerogative of the company to release you during your trial period. So I wasn't even getting acquainted. I wasn't looking to left nor to right. I wasn't even very friendly. I just came and did my work, punched my time clock, and out I went every day. And I came within a matter of 4 or 5 days of getting my seniority, and all the time, the men outside of these cribs, outside of our crib, Department 15, was the world's largest press room under one roof in Briggs, our Mack Avenue plant. It was a huge thing, the biggest presses you ever saw in your life. And they had the most militant division there, and it was the chief steward of that department was a guy by the name of Roy Snowden, and he was the former captain of the flying squadron of Briggs Local that brought the troops down the trenches, you know, and a very militant the department.
And the men didn't try to recruit the women into the union, the women in the cribs?
They couldn't get into the cribs to talk to them. And they could stop some of them, try to stop some of them on the way out, but we had to go through the department and out different avenues. The whole plant was two huge blocks long. Huge. It was a huge thing. And it was very, very difficult because women, when they punch a time clock, they don't want to stop for anything. They have to get right home, and especially in a large city where they have to take a streetcar, wait for a bus, and if you're the last one, you don't get on the bus and stand out there in the snow freezing to death. So they didn't have any success, and this old Mr. Powell coming in would talk to a few of them. And yet few who knew that they should have a union because they had male foremen left over from the driving the men in there, resented women. The army crib foreman especially was a real woman hater. And he would come up. He would come up to a girl that was having difficulties and say, "Get the rag out, sister. You're being paid for this." And the nastiest things that came out of his mouth, Eddie Bellamy. Oh, that little bastard. And I used to have to listen to all of this. And girls would cry and just break down and go to the restroom and come back, and he'd ride them. We had another one, Fraser, in the Navy. He's the Air Force. I don't remember too well. It's hazy. Fraser had his own little ways of getting up and sidling toward women, making girlfriends out of them. He had the other technique. And it was a terrible department as far as trying to organize. And that's why women didn't have too much success. After all, the steward, the old man walking in and out, wasn't the guy that they played up to in the Navy crib, or wasn't the guy they had to protect them during working hours, you see.
Well, you know what? Each of the divisions of the armed forces had its own foreman, in other words, and they watched over the inspection.
They were all Briggs. You see, it was a cost-plus program.
Mm-hmm.
And when these planes were put together, we had to inspect, especially in aluminum, for splits, because once air pressure up in the air gets into a tiny split in a part, it rips. Aluminum rips. It's not like steel. And they had to have their inspection, their Army ordnance people come in daily and confer, and just to make sure that there was no sabotage in the inspection department. This is where it would be the best place to sabotage a plane.
So this was basically a security measure.
Oh, yes.
The foreman from each of the services that watched the inspection.
Yes, but they were Briggs employees. They were old-time Briggs employees, you see. And, you know, they were used to handling men. They resented women coming in there, and they would tell us over and over again, "You wait, this war is over. Your asses will be out where they belong. You'll be back in your homes," and so on. And so I had to taste this, and a few days before, some of the girls were wise enough to know that they couldn't tolerate this kind of business, no matter how big the pay was. And so they came around, they were going to have a meeting. They had one meeting, and I was successful in turning them off and saying I couldn't. I had other things very important. And then they had a second meeting. This time they were going to have somebody from the local, one of the men come in from the local and tell them what they could do about some of the things that had been happening in the department. And that meant they were going to have the old man, first chair of the first meeting, they were going to have somebody that had more authority than he had. And so they were trying to get the girls out. And it came to me over and over again. Two of them that were doing the organizing came to me, "Well, what's the matter with you? Don't you want to stick with the rest of us? And me sitting there and taking that, it was terrible. And I think I succeeded until about quitting time, just a few minutes before. And then they came up and they made me feel like 2 cents waiting for change. So me and my little bright mind, I think, well, all right, I'm going to go. I said, all right, I'll walk over there with you. I'll sit in the back of the hall and I'll keep my mouth shut. I've only got these few days to wait. And so we went over there, and it was a fairly well-attended. The girls had done a pretty good job of getting them out. And then they just waited for somebody from the locals to come in and tell them something. And who came in? Emil Macy. And Emil was up there giving them a speech, and he kept looking down in my direction. I kept my head down. Now, one attribute of that guy is he's got a memory like an elephant. And he kept looking in my direction. Now, remember, I was in Flint. He was in Detroit. I don't think we had met too many times, just a few times. And finally, at a part in his speech, he stopped and he said, wait just a minute. I don't know what you need me up here for. Sitting back there is one of the original organizers of the UAW. She was in Flint. Janora? And, of course, I had the first and I put my head up like that. And the rest of the women in that department were so shocked because they had been begging me to come, you know. And so I got up and I was shaking all over and I said, well, I don't have my seniority yet, trying to tip him off, you know. And I said, I'm sure that we women can get it together in the department. But I didn't want to say too much because I knew we had some stool pigeons right there in that meeting.
How many women attended the meeting?
That first meeting, they must have had about 40 women.
And how many were in working
groups? About 580 or something like
but
that.
Women came to
that thing. Yeah. And, of course, to them, it looked like a big group sticking together because they had been so decimated. So afterward, I went up to him and I said, oh, my God, I think you just threw me out of the water, Emil. I've only got so many days left. And he was scheduled then to leave, you know. And he said, look, I want to tell you something. They fired you and we'll pull the whole goddamn 18,000 workers down. Well, Emil, that was the talk in those days. And when Emil said something, he meant it. So I went back into the plant, and I think they got me the day after, or a few days after. I don't remember the timing on this at all. Emil had been drafted and left for the Army. Just Peraza was the new president, but he had left instructions about me because I was concerned. I was definitely concerned that I wasn't going to make it, you know. And I knew this was the ideal position for me to be in because there are many women who can't talk to other women in those days. You know, more of them can now, but they couldn't. There were all kinds of petty hang-ups. And I liked women because I'd had the experience of trusting them and knowing what their potential was from the Flint organization. And I knew this was a situation I could do some good in. So, sure enough, they fired me. And just for as it pulled down 18,000.
What did they get?
My previous record. I had lied on my application form. I had been fired from Flint. I had been active in Flint and I had a police record in Flint, that's the way they put it. And one other thing that I don't know what it was. Anyway, but that was the reason. I had lied on my application. That was the main one.
Mm-hmm.
So they called this man in from to prove that I had lied. You know, I said, well, I don't know why I lied. I didn't work under the name of Dollinger. And in fact, that's the way I took it. And it was so worded that you could take it that way. And but you misled our interviewer, our personnel man. I said, would you please bring him down? And they brought that man down. And when I got that man there, I said, didn't you offer me a job in the personnel office, Mr. Whatever his name was? The man turned bleak red. He was so embarrassed. How could he have been so wrong? I said, you told me that you thought that I belonged in the inspection department, didn't you? You didn't think that I belonged over on the drill press job at Verner Highway Plant. And he said, I don't know how in the world, he said, well, he didn't know then what he knew now or something. He was so embarrassed because he was such a really a nice, nice guy, you know. He was supposed to have caught cases like that. So anyway, the union pulled down the 18,000 workers.
How did that happen? What did that look like in terms of how did they reach people? What did they tell them?
Oh, Briggs Local was a well-organized, even known as Dead End Kids of the International Union, UAW. And their stewards had power, much more power and much more militancy than any other local in the city of Detroit. And at that time, it was the second largest local in the city of Detroit, and it was a cohesive thing, even though it too had been, you know, blood white from their young people, young men being drafted into the army. But Emil Mises had his personal stamp is on that. And he was a man who had a lot of lieutenants, personal lieutenants attached to him, who wanted to emulate him, and they were fearless. Jess Barraza, listen to these Italian names, and Jess Barraza, who became the president, and Roy Snowden, an Irishman, Steve Despot, a Hungarian, and all of these really militant guys, Irish and Polish and the rest of them in there, you know. They were from the east side of Detroit that had a lot of Poles, a lot of Hungarians, and a lot of immigrant families. And these were second generation people, but they knew, you know, what the Union did to change their lives.
What's the point in the time of the Union? Was the rest of the plant predominantly?
Well, no, you're talking about something, it's a process here that we're talking about. It's not a static thing. As the young men were, the old members, it was a well-organized union. The old members were being drafted out, and in were coming people from the South, blacks for the first time, and in were coming housewives, and from other states besides just the blacks. Other states were transferring into Detroit. It became a great dynamic. Detroit was the production center of the war effort. And so as they were leaving by one door out of a local union, in were coming the others, and the ones that were left had the big job of trying to educate and not let their standards and their traditions be broken down. And believe me, they were having a hell of a time trying to maintain that. The standards that they had set.
18,000 people were killed.
Yeah.
Did that represent the entire Plant 15?
No, wait a minute. They had plants, they had four or five plants in different locations. Mack Avenue was their central and biggest plant. Then they had Vernon Highway, and they had 8 Mile Plant and a couple of others. Outer Drive Plant. And in this, you had your chief steward of every plant, and he took one telephone call. The chief steward to the line stewards and your committee men. There I was a chief steward, which would have been the same thing as a committeeman in a GM setup. They had different names. And they just transmitted the information through their grapevine. And if that plant was scheduled, they would say 10 o'clock, pull a switch. That plant went down. That was
okay, even though they weren't yet in the union, would go to it.
Yes, because they were one plant that educated right on the job, and they really had control of that plant. I mean, the chief steward of the department didn't work in that plant. In the press room, that Roy Snowden would walk up and down, and every new worker that came in, he would start on him right away. Do you know how much I came into this plant and worked for? Do you know what the conditions were? Do you know what the bosses used to do? And, of course, those were men. It was easier for him to talk that way to men. And for women, we had to use an entirely different tactic, but we still, you know, used the idea of women working for 12 and a half cents an hour in Flint, and the foreman using them sexually and so on.
Well, so when you were told you were fired, what you then called the union and told them? How did it all happen?
Well, when you're fired, you're given a pink slip. You're called up the management's office, bam, and you're given a pink slip, you clock out. And then as I clocked out, I had to, which time was this? The first time? What did I do? The third time was the interesting time. By this time, they were so intimidated by me, the third time I was fired, that they sent a guy that must have been 7 feet tall, and I don't know how many feet wide, a huge, big, giant of a man. He was the biggest man in the plant protection man. Sent him down to escort me out. I don't know what they thought I was going to do. And I said, wait just a moment, I have to collect my things. No, you were to leave the plant immediately. They'd have me up in the plant manager's office, and I was charged with everything but raping my grandmother the third time, you know.
But the and, third time you clocked out and then told?
Naturally, I went right to the local. I don't know whether I was telling line stewards on the way out. You see, this is a 2-block walk. You have to make out one door, or you can make maybe a 1/2-block walk out the other. And I always took the 2-block walk out Mack Avenue. They couldn't tell me which entrance I was going out. I think probably I told people on the way out. But maybe it was only one or two, like Roy Smooth and the ones that I had just gotten acquainted with, because remember, I was fired very early in the game the first time. Then I went to the local, and I said, Jess, you remember when I, you know, the agreement with Maisie? Absolutely, I remember. The plant won't go in, the second shift won't go in tonight. Or I don't know whether they decided to pull tickets out on the morning shift or however it was, but all of the plants, all five plants went down in Detroit, and it didn't take us long for me to get back on.
And
their specific one was that you'd be rehired? Oh, yes, of course. And I was rehired, and I was elected chief steward.
How long were you out?
Oh, I think that was a matter of 50 days.
Oh, it was that long?
Wait a minute.
Many of the wildcats were short, weren't they?
No, that was only two shifts. That would have only been, yes, one day, that first time.
And did they just walk out, or did they then actually take it through?
They had their people posted on the front, you know, don't go in, they're on strike. And they had maintained that kind of control in Briggs Local that you got your head busted if you went across the picket line, you know, at that time. They had a reputation, too, the Dead End Kids of Detroit. And so they could do those things. It had more wildcat strikes than any other local in the city.
Now, by that time, there had already been a tradition of wildcats had already developed. This was not one of the first wildcats that did.
No, but the wildcats, yeah, during the war period?
No, this first time when they walked out.
No. It had been developed, yes. Yes, absolutely. And at that time, people in the other plants didn't even know me. I hadn't spoken to them at the general membership meetings or anything. So they didn't even know me. This was the power of the amazing group that was the officers of the union. Yeah, I think that was two shifts, only one day. And they had this meeting right away with calling in this personnel director, and I was put back to work. And I was then, of course, elected chief steward. And
how did that happen?
We called a department meeting in 15, and the girls said, oh, my gosh, you know. And there was no question about it. I was elected.
So they then immediately joined the union after the walkout?
Yeah. Well, let me see. No, it was a checkoff, I think. Of course, it was a checkoff. They had the checkoff then. Union dues deducted from your paycheck. But it was the union actions inside. There could be a scab and have them taken out, you know, and complain about the money going out of your check. But you could be reporting everything to the foreman. You could be breaking down the conditions. And we had a couple of, we had one school teacher and one nurse that were absolutely despicable women. Despicable reports if a girl paid over 5 minutes in the can, or if she was talking too much or something. There's still pigeons in there.
But they belong to the union.
Well, they would belong on paper, you know. Like, you belong to the United States government, but you can be a terrorist. They were real scabs. They were real non-union people, and perhaps the deduction was being made to the union.
You know, when you were elected, Chief Steward, was this for the
crib
area or for the total?
This is for the total. They had chief stewards of every department because the operations and the techniques of manufacture were different in every department. And this blueprint inspection was entirely different operation. This is the all of the department, 580 people. It's a small department in size. But it was for the Army, Navy, and Air Force crib, the whole department, 15.
And up until your election, it was just this old man who basically
came in from another department.
Department.
Yeah, and he kind of hobnobbed around with the superintendent and talked a little bit and asked the girls, got any problems? Let me know. But now we had a real representative, and he called regular meetings. And
tell me a little bit about the working conditions and your hours.
Well, let's see. He went in at, clocked in at, was it 6? Or 7, and worked 8 hours. We had a coffee break. We had pretty good conditions there. We had a half-hour lunch period, which was very difficult for me to get used to. And usually, the girls ate at the tables, the inspection tables, because it was so hard. You couldn't run to the cafeteria and come back in this huge plant. We had a coffee break in the morning, but I don't think we had one in the afternoon.
Now, did you have bathroom facilities right in the crib area?
Oh, God, no. You had to walk the block to a cold old can, you know. These plants haven't been transformed to accommodate women that much. They just had perhaps added on another wall and some more toilet cubicles.
And what were the working arrangements? Were there tables?
Yes, large tables, and then they had the big gondolas of stock that would be brought in, and you'd check out at the you'd check out your blueprints and your tools and so on, and you had to check these pieces constantly. It wasn't just one. It wasn't the masterpiece on the thing. Check the flanges, the measurements, and the plus, at the same time, always checking for splits and all that.
And you were checking a variety of pieces. It wasn't that each of you had a certain part to inspect all of the inspected arranged parts?
Oh, no. You had the guys, whatever came through there, all of these small parts that had to be inspected, you know. And then pretty fairly large ones, too. We had them hitting the ceiling, too. Mm. But the majority of them were small because so many small parts go to make up an airplane.
How many of you would be in table?
I think probably there would be, the tables were long, probably 1, 2, 3, about 6, I think, on each side, 3 on each side, because you had so much stock in front of you, and you were working out of this bin constantly on wheels. When that was done, you put a tag on it, and out it went. You had to sign, you know, your slips that you had inspected it, and all kinds of parts. You wouldn't get the same part every day, you know, you'd have to check out the difference and go after it.
Thank you.